This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
A traditionally big buying day for the American consumer turned into a big selling day on Wall Street as a new variant of concern emerges. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, November 26th. Good to have you with us. The world woke up today to fears of a new, potentially more contagious variant of the coronavirus, first detected in South Africa. Dozens of countries are restricting travel to and from that region, including the United States, starting on Monday. And concerns about further restrictions rattled the global markets. With me today to talk about all of that and more are Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post and Brian Chung with Yahoo Finance. Welcome back, both of you.
Hey, Amy.
Hi, Amy.
We're going to get to the latest on this variant of the virus in a bit, but before that, I want to talk about some pretty big economic news that happened this week. For a holiday week, it was pretty busy. Let's start, Catherine, with the Fed and President Biden's decision to renominate Jerome Powell for another term as chair. What does that decision tell you about where monetary policy might be headed?
Well, both Powell and the potential alternate candidate, Lael Brainard, who will in turn be nominated for a vice chair post, were considered pretty dovish and are likely to perhaps be less worried about inflation than other people considered more hawkish might be. I think in the near term, the Fed has a really difficult decision, whoever is in charge of it, because there is this growing concern about whether the economy has been overheating, whether the Fed needs to accelerate its tapering and or its so-called liftoff, you know, raising interest rates. But given the renewed threat of another COVID variant, that has complicated what their plans will be going forward. But I think the expectation is that, you know, markets trust Powell, that they will give him the benefit of the doubt in guiding this economy through this very challenging period.
Brian, some Democrats had been pushing for Lael Brainard, who Biden tapped to be vice chair. What kind of impact could she have in that role?
Well, what's also interesting is that she was nominated for the vice chair role of the Federal Reserve, as opposed to the vice chair of supervision role, which is a separate post that has to do with regulatory policy. And in fact, a lot of progressives were kind of wondering, could it be a compromise if Brainard, who was seen by some as more aggressive on bank regulatory policy, both in terms of capital and liquidity requirements, but also in terms of climate-related financial risks, it actually was a bit of a surprise that the Biden administration chose to nominate her for the regular vice chair role, which has a little bit more of a hand in the monetary policy side of things than on the regulatory side of things. But among the progressives, I'm thinking of Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts. She's likely to be a shoo-in. We've also seen some of the kind of Democrats in the Senate who are more aggressive on climate change also say they support her. A bit unclear about whether or not Powell will face questions on that when he faces testimony in the Senate Banking Committee and by the Senate at large. That's going to kind of be interesting as we see them get their nomination process through the Senate. Now, of course, both of them have been Senate confirmed before, which is a big reason why no one really expects them to have difficulty getting through the Senate this time around.
Keeping with the Fed for a minute, we also got the minutes from the last meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, where officials debated how quickly they should put the brakes on rising inflation. And as Catherine mentioned, you know, this new variant kind of makes all of that fine print a little bit moot. But I'm wondering what we did learn from that discussion about how soon we might see interest rates rise. Catherine?
Well, from the minutes that were released, it looked like the members of that committee were pushing for a faster drawdown in monthly asset purchases than they had previously been considering. And that's partly because of these growing fears that high inflation will prove to be more persistent than had been forecast, right? Month after month after month, we've been seeing the inflation numbers come in stronger than had been predicted, particularly relative to the forecasts from last spring. Now, again, very hard to say because what will happen going forward given this news about the variant, which obviously broke to the world that the news that is after long enough after this meeting occurred and the minutes were released. But it does look like it did look like at least at the time that this meeting happened that Fed officials were getting a little bit antsy about the existing pace that had been described to the public about the taper.
Yeah, I mean, about this variant, which the WHO is calling Omicron, which I have to say just sounds ominous. Judging from the market reaction, there is a lot of concern out there about what this could mean for the global recovery. Brian, we obviously don't want to make too much of this before we know how much to make of it. But what could that mean for the U.S. and for the globe?
Yeah, it does sound a little like a bad sci-fi movie, but we did see the activity in the markets today. They're taking it very seriously, right? You saw the Dow fall by as much as 1,000 points in what was a short, abbreviated trading day today. And fair, you know, to be fair, the volume on a day like this, on a holiday day, is a bit weird and kind of unusual. But it's notable when you see things like a flight to safety. In addition to the equities selling off, you saw the commensurate decline in treasury yields, which shows people are trying to run to safe haven assets, perceived to be safe haven assets like U.S. treasuries, longer dated bonds like the 10-year or the 30-year falling by over 10 basis points. This shows the jitteriness by which investors around the world are looking at this variant. And it doesn't have to be a shutdown in the United States. Politically, that sounds like something that would be unlikely to happen. But you see what's going on in Austria. You see Germany dealing with the political argument about whether or not they should lock down. Countries in Asia are now thinking about, you know, serious travel restrictions. This is something that a lot of people are going to be watching, especially as the science comes out about the transmissibility of this new variant. That's going to present some more economic risk during a time when, at least here in the United States, there was that hope and optimism that we were going to get to the other side, even if the vaccination rates continued to stall a little bit. Now, obviously, this could be a serious downside risk. There's still a lot of science that needs to become out there in terms of what really is the risk of this new variant. But at least for right now, you can see just how sensitive financial markets are to this new downside risk.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there for today. Thank you both so much, Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post and Brian Chung with Yahoo Finance. Have a good weekend.
Thanks,
Thank
Amy.
you.
On Wall Street today, it was actually the worst Black Friday for stocks on record. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Okay, now to all that buying. Black Friday has long been more of a season than a single day. But even so, the National Retail Federation is expecting this one to be one of the busiest shopping days of the year. And it's been a busy year. We learned earlier this week that consumer spending rose more than expected in October, 1.3%. That's double the increase in September, though some of that was due to higher prices. And it continues the mostly upward trend we've been seeing all year. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at what's going on and how long it might last.
Sentiment numbers out this week say consumers are worried about the economy. But spending numbers say consumers are opening their wallets without much worry. Gregory Dacko is an economist at Oxford Economics.
What you need to pay attention to is really what consumers are buying, not what they're saying.
And despite all the woes about supply chains and inflation, what they're buying is stuff, and lots of it. Spending on goods is above pre-pandemic levels, with a few caveats, of course. Carola Binder, an economist at Haverford College, says supply chain problems have likely given spending a temporary boost.
I think partly it's consumers trying to do some of their holiday shopping early.
The other caveat, inflation. If something costs more, well, that drives up spending. Still, overall, spending rose more than inflation. More Americans are working again, and overall household balance sheets are strong. Also, the more permanent the pandemic has started to feel, the more permanent our pandemic spending behaviors have become. John Lear in Washington, D.C. is still working from home and mostly eating in, which means his grocery bill is up. He also recently bought a car.
Those are all changes in consumers' lifestyles that have tremendous ripple effects for all of their other spending activities.
Lear is an economist at Morning Consult, by the way, and he thinks some of the spending might stick around as the pandemic goes on, and maybe for a while after supply chain problems ease for big ticket items people are waiting for, like couches and cars.
Once that inventory materializes, I would expect consumers to go out and start making those purchases.
All of this, though, is dependent on what happens with the virus as new variants continue to emerge. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Apprenticeships are a common path to a good job in trades like construction, plumbing, and masonry, all male-dominated jobs with above-average wages. But a handful of states, including California, now certify apprenticeships in early childhood education, where women make up the vast majority of the workforce. From KPCC, Mariana Dale reports now on how on-the-job training might help some of the country's lowest-paid workers.
Family childcare provider Carmen Della Lamo says new parents often ask if she's had any training.
And yes, I say, of course I have.
She can point to the framed teacher certificate on the wall. And a tour of her Granada Hills home shows she's put the child development classes required for it into action.
My place is divided in different areas. I have science areas and math areas together.
There's also a sensory area where toddlers can run their little hands over different textures, including scratchy blades of synthetic grass.
And this one is a little bit rough.
Della Lamo was a nurse in Peru before moving to Los Angeles and opening her home childcare more than 10 years ago. She earned her teaching certificate through an apprenticeship that offered classes on nights and weekends, paid a stipend, and came with other supports like free textbooks and a computer. Randy Wolf runs Early Care and Education Pathways to Success and helped create the program.
We set up a program that's going to meet the needs of first-generation college students, of working full-time mothers.
Hundreds of people have completed the on-the-job training program since 2016, and there are now around a dozen early childhood apprenticeships in the state.
It's not just about getting more college credit. It's not just about getting a raise. It's not just about advancing from one position to another. It pulls it all together in one nice package.
But pay is stubbornly low, even for well-qualified early educators. Abby Koopman-Pettig is the research director at the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at the University of California, Berkeley.
Whereas in many fields, you can expect to earn significantly higher wages as you meet, you know, significant milestones like degrees. That's not always the case with early education.
The center found the median wage for childcare workers nationwide is $11.65 an hour. Preschool teachers make a few bucks more. Wolf says California's apprenticeship programs are largely supported by philanthropy with some public funding. She points out to the donors that the shortage of early childhood educators has a ripple effect.
Ignore us at your own peril, because if you don't have childcare in your community, I think these electricians are going to go to work. I think these advanced manufacturers are going to go to work.
The low pay has made the apprenticeships a tough sell to some would-be donors. One of the newest programs aims to expand the workforce by enrolling high school juniors in college courses and placing them in summer childcare jobs. Education policy experts like Kara Sklar at the think tank New America say there are reasons for caution.
It's important to acknowledge concerns about the equity implications of creating career pathways for high school students, particularly young women of color from families with low incomes and also immigrant youth, to work in the undervalued and low-paying field of early ed.
Sklar says apprenticeships can't boost the wages of the field on their own, and families can't afford to pay more for childcare. The answer, she says, is federal, state, and local dollars dedicated to raising the salaries of early educators. In Los Angeles, I'm Mariana Dale for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The fastest growing service I've ever seen.
Come on, really? But first, let's do the numbers. Markets closed in the red this Black Friday amid concerns over that new coronavirus variant. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 905 points, 2.5% to close at 34,899. The NASDAQ fell 353 points, 2.2% to finish at 15,491. And the S&P 500 was down 106 points, also 2.2% to finish at 4,594. By one research estimate, American shoppers had already spent three quarters of their holiday gift budgets before Black Friday. So let's see how some major retailers did today. Target lost 0.8%. Walmart fell 1.1%. Amazon gave back 2.1%. And that flight to safety, bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.47%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Tensions are high between two major American industries right now, aviation and telecom. At issue is whether 5G, the much-hyped wireless network with faster download speeds, could mess up safety equipment on planes and helicopters. Yeah, not a small concern. AT&T and Verizon were set to turn on expanded 5G services next month until a last-minute warning from the FAA postponed the launch. Marketplace's Matt Levin has more.
So 5G is already out there on the airwaves, obviously, but part of the reason the reviews so far have been kind of meh? Big Telecom has been waiting to activate a specific range of 5G frequencies, something called the C-band. John Metzler researches the telecom industry at UC Berkeley.
And it fills a very important gap for the wireless carriers. You know, so you've got kind of the Goldilocks of spectrum. You know, this one's wide area, this one's very narrow, or this one's just right.
AT&T and Verizon spent more than $68 billion to buy rights to the C-band in an FCC auction last year, which is just the tip of their investment.
Hundreds of millions of subscribers at stake and further tens of billions of dollars that have been invested in network equipment.
But switching on that C-band could maybe, theoretically, potentially mess up altimeters, a pretty important piece of aviation equipment. Hassan Shahidi is president of the Flight Safety Foundation.
It is used to help the airplanes land safely when you have low visibility conditions. It's also used in the collision avoidance system.
Still, many say the threats are largely theoretical. Tom Wheeler chaired the FCC under President Obama.
The 5G spectrum is authorized for use around the world, and we haven't seen great difficulties.
Wheeler says a major question is who should pay for updating older altimeters, which could be more vulnerable, maybe. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
From super fast wireless to super fast delivery, remember when next day service seemed quick? Then same day came along. Now, nearly 2 years into this pandemic, you can order some products like popcorn for a movie or a bag of ice for an impromptu cocktail hour and be munching or sipping 10 to 20 minutes later. It's caught on big time in London, which is where the BBC's Victoria Craig takes us next.
At this coffee shop in central London, baristas are slinging artisan brews while the buzz of conversation fills the air and influencers pose for selfies with branded swag bags. This shop, at least for the afternoon, belongs to GoPuff to celebrate its launch in the UK this month.
We deliver anything from ice cream, groceries, snacks, alcohol, medicine, baby products in 20 minutes, 24/7.
That's Yakir Gola, co-founder and co-CEO of the Superfast Delivery Company, which was set up in the U.S. 8 years ago.
We have over 500 micro-fulfillment centers in over 1,000 cities. We have a near 80% market share in the U.S., and the business has transformed a lot.
Through the acquisition of two London-based companies, GoPuff's launch in 10 cities across this country in November marks its first official foray into international markets. And Gola believes his company's establishment in the market is helping determine its success against startup competitors. In June, GoPuff completed its latest funding round, giving it a valuation of $15 billion. Backers include giants like Blackstone Horizons, Guggenheim, and SoftBank's Vision Fund. But competition is fierce, as Bain & Company's Ruth Lewis explains.
We've seen that investors have plowed over $14 billion into rapid grocery delivery apps since the start of the pandemic.
She said in the first 3 months of this year, more venture capital investment went into ultra-fast delivery services than during the whole of 2020. And you can see the money at work. In London alone, it's impossible to board a train or walk down the street without being bombarded by ads for GoPuff's many competitors. They all follow the same idea of super-fast, hyper-local delivery, but they vary slightly in terms of minimum delivery fees or guaranteed door-to-door times, which means industry consolidation is inevitable, according to Lewis.
Some of the big food delivery players are thinking about how they might position themselves in this market. And it's the same for the big supermarket chains. They're thinking about how they might participate in their partnering or acquiring players to do so.
Indeed, Carrefour, the world's eighth biggest supermarket operator based in central France, has several rapid delivery options for its customers with late-night ice cream cravings or last-minute cat food needs. Here's the company's director of data and e-commerce, Elodie Pertrisseau.
We launched our own express delivery platform and we partner with Uber. And it's been probably the fastest growing service I've ever seen in e-commerce.
The partnership, she says, has in the last year raked in more than $113 million in rapid delivery sales. She said the fact that customers are sticking with it signals it's not just a pandemic era shopping solution.
When you're back to a normal life, you also are in a hurry. You want to be more efficient. You're cooking your recipe and you need the sugar. You have the solution in super fast delivery. We think it's really only the beginning.
A win then for established players. But Bain's Ruth Lewis says a number of growing pains still lie ahead for the newcomers.
Right now, the focus of these companies is on attracting new customers to sign up for the service. In order to do that, they're offering big money off incentives on each order. And this is something that they'll have to move away from in the long term to become profitable.
She estimates that to break even, each day these companies will need to complete 1,000 orders, costing at least $40 each. That is far above deliveries like this one, which totals about $8 for 4 jumbo bags of chips, the same number of pasta boxes, and a package of mini plastic shot glasses. So while consumers might be happy to incorporate another form of e-commerce into their repertoire, it begs the ultimate question. Can players in this red-hot space drive pandemic-induced demand into long-lasting profits? In London, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace.
This final note before we go, if you're wondering how your COVID-19 vaccine might hold up against the new variant, Pfizer and BioNTech say they're testing and should have results within 2 weeks and could start shipping a new version of the vaccine, if necessary, within 100 days. Moderna says it's planning to rapidly advance an Omicron-specific booster, and Johnson & Johnson says it's started testing too. Shares in Pfizer and Moderna shot up today. J&J fell. All right, we got to go. So here's your moment of economic context. It seems like every day we learn of a new product in short supply. But this one honestly surprised me. Huckleberries. Bloomberg says prices have doubled in the last 2 years to $17 a pound, thanks to higher demand for a crop that suffered from extreme summer heat in the Northwest. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fregali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Amy Scott. We will be back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.